Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. This is another mini-episode, this time on the neutrality patrols, which are the not-so-neutral patrols and the shooting war before the actual shooting war of World War II in the North Atlantic. If you're looking for a comprehensive step-through of U.S. naval history, the first 19 episodes of this podcast do that chronologically, and I highly recommend that you go back and listen to all those if you have not already. Episode 10 covers World War II in the Atlantic and Mediterranean theaters, which only very briefly touches on the shooting war, or the actual shooting war with the German submarines in the North Atlantic, prior to Pearl Harbor. And as always, if you like this podcast, please share it with whoever you think might enjoy it. For those U.S. Navy sailors serving in the Atlantic, World War II effectively started before December 7th, 1941, which is when the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Of course, the war had been raging in Asia since 1939, and in Europe since 1940. But for the most part, the United States was not yet involved in the greater war, aside from some lend-lease operations. Increasingly, though, President Roosevelt was convinced that the United States had to get involved. He slowly started granting more permissions for the Navy to take on quasi-combat roles, which eventually turned into something just short of full-blown combat operations by the time December 7th, 1941 rolled around. The fact is that the United States Navy was in an undeclared shooting war with the Kriegsmarine and the North Atlantic. President Roosevelt and other senior U.S. political leaders were convinced that it was absolutely necessary for U.S. national security that the United Kingdom not be allowed to fall to the German war machine, which had yet to suffer a significant setback in their war in Europe. The possibility that the Royal Navy, which at that time was still the biggest in the world, could fall into Nazi hands as the French Navy did just a few months earlier was terrifying. After the fall of France, Britain had acted quickly to capture or sink most of the French fleet because of similar concerns about the French fleet falling into German hands. The official and very top-secret Royal Navy plan in the event of the fall of mainland Britain was to sail for the Dominions and for the United States and to fight on from overseas. But that calculus could change in a minute if the Germans were holding Britain itself hostage, and who knows what the final political settlement would be. If Germany captured the Royal Navy fleet more or less intact, that would give the Germans the ability to come and strike at the United States homeland, something that they were currently many, many years of a very large shipbuilding program away from, because Germany just didn't have a high seas fleet capable of protecting and escorting an invasion force, despite a very capable submarine fleet. A submarine fleet is a very good and cost-effective way of interdicting and raiding enemy shipping, but it is not capable of power projection. However, if the Germans were able to capture all of the Royal Navy's battleships and destroyers and a couple of aircraft carriers, suddenly the United States would have a very big problem on its hands, especially if mainland Britain fell and all of our shipyards also came into German hands at the same time. And so as a result, the United States seriously pressed the envelope on quote-unquote neutrality. And these violations were eventually cited in Germany's very stupid declaration of war against the United States post-Pearl Harbor. During these so-called neutrality patrols, the United States and Britain agreed that U.S. Navy assets would escort convoys halfway across the Atlantic to the rough dividing line of Iceland before handing over the escort duties to British escorts. This meant that the British only had to go half as far so that the escorts would be twice as good, in addition to deterring German attacks on the American side of Iceland before the convoy got to the handoff point, because the Germans at least learned the most important lesson from World War I called, try not to get the Americans involved. And because the Germans were not complete idiots, their Navy was under strict orders not to attack U.S. Navy warships, although this identification problem became a little more challenging after we loaned, aka gave, the British 50 of our very old World War I vintage four Piper destroyers. And so on April 10th, 1941, USS Nyblack, DD-424, dropped depth charges on a German U-boat without result, but this was arguably the first U.S. shot of World War II. And then on September 4th, 1941, which just so happens to be 82 years from today, the USS Greer, DD-145, which was a very old, recommissioned World War I-era four-stack destroyer, was bringing supplies and mail to Iceland for the 6,000 U.S. Marines who had taken over occupation duty of the country from the British, after the British had preemptively invaded the country to prevent a possible German invasion attempt. And now this is a very friendly British invasion, as invasions go. But it was nonetheless an invasion. The United States, still officially neutral, was occupying Iceland for the British so that the British could focus their troops and logistics elsewhere. And so all this is to say that war makes you make hard choices. And here I'm going to read a bit from Craig L. Simon's very excellent book, World War II at Sea. As it breasted the choppy seas, an RAF long-range patrol plane flew overhead and signaled by blinker light that its surface U-boat was 10 miles away. The Greer's commanding officer, Lieutenant Commander Lawrence H. Frost, ordered a change in course to close in on it. Frost had no intention of attacking the U-boat. His plan was to track and report its position in conformance with standing orders. The U-boat had submerged by the time Frost found it, and he began tracking it with his sonar. The skipper of U-652, with the Greer's sonar pinging relentlessly in his ears and his batteries running low, had no way of knowing the nationality of the vessel, which was pursuing him so relentlessly. The British patrol plane dropped several depth charges, all of which missed. But since he was submerged, the U-boat captain could not see the source of the explosives, and concluded that they had come from the destroyer above him. After 3.5 hours, he worked himself into a position to fire 2 torpedoes at his tormentor. Both missed. Having been attacked, however, Frost responded by dropping a flurry of depth charges of his own. Neither vessel was damaged, but it was the first exchange of live ammunition between German and American naval forces. Roosevelt expressed outrage at the German affront in a fireside chat a week later. Whether his outrage was genuine or feigned, he told his radio audience that the Greer
was proceeding on a legitimate mission,
and that the German U-boat had fired a torpedo
without warning and with deliberate design to sink her.
As a result, he announced, American vessels in the North Atlantic would no longer wait for approximate threat before opening fire.
When you see a rattlesnake poised to strike, you do not wait until he is struck before you crush him.
From now on, Roosevelt declared, American warships in the Atlantic would shoot first.
The time for active defense is now. Do not let us split hairs. Let us not say we will only defend ourselves if the torpedo succeeds in getting home, or if the crew and the passengers are drowned. This is the time for prevention of attack. If submarines or raiders attack in distant waters, they can attack equally well within sight of our own shores. Their very presence in any waters which America deems vital to its defense constitutes an attack. In the waters which we deem necessary for our defense, American naval vessels and American planes will no longer wait until Axis submarines lurking under the water or Axis raiders on the surface of the sea strike their deadly blow first. Upon our naval and air patrol, now operating in large number over a vast expanse of the Atlantic Ocean, falls the duty of maintaining the American policy of freedom of the seas now. That means, very simply, very clearly, that our patrolling vessels and planes protect all merchant ships, not only American ships, but ships of any flag.
This is obviously far more than neutral. And this was very alarming to a large percentage of the public and Congress, which was still very isolationist and did not want to risk the United States getting involved in a war, especially one with the seemingly invincible German army, which had just steamrolled Poland, France, and the British Army in North Africa, and looked like they were well on their way to doing the same against the Soviet Union's Red Army. Leningrad and Kiev had just been surrounded, and it was very far from clear that there would be anyone left to oppose the Germans on continental Europe by the time 1942 rolled around. Remember that the U.S. Army went into World War II with an end strength of about 189,000, which ranked about 17th in effectiveness among the armies of the world, just behind the renowned fighting force of Romania, and not exactly in a good position to win a war against what at that point was very clearly the best army in the world. Although at this point, military spending was increasing rapidly. On October 17, 1941, USS Kearney, DD-432, responded to a German U-boat Wolfpack attack. The Wolfpack is when several submarines attack a convoy together, which is a lot more effective than an individual U-boat attack, because together the U-boats could overwhelm a convoy escort force. In this case, the Wolfpack had overwhelmed a Canadian escort force. The U.S. convoy escorts responded by conducting several depth charge attacks on German U-boats before being hit and damaged by a torpedo fired from U-568, which killed 11 U.S. sailors and wounded 22 more. This obviously helped escalate the conflict, and on Halloween, October 31st, 1941, the USS Reuben James, DD-245, positioned herself between an ammunition ship and a German Wolfpack to try and dissuade the German Wolfpack from firing on the ammunition ship. And just as an aside, can you imagine being on an ammunition ship in a war zone transporting, well, ammunition? I mean, the merchant mariners were every bit as heroic, every bit as vital, and put themselves in every bit as much danger as any U.S. Navy sailor throughout the war. And we don't really have the equivalent today of a large merchant mariner community here in the United States. And transport is extremely important. Logistics are what win wars. And the sad truth is that we don't have the national capacity to win a tonnage war today. China does, in part because they have lower labor costs, but mainly because the Chinese recognize the importance of a shipbuilding industry in wartime, and they subsidize the hell out of their shipbuilding industry. According to the 2022 United Nations Conference on Trade and Development Statistics Handbook, China built 44.2% of the world's merchant fleet last year, compared to the United States' 0.053% of the world's total merchant fleet. I'm generally a very pro-free market, keep the subsidies to a minimum sort of guy, but this is absolutely unacceptable, and we need to have a domestic shipbuilding industry in this country, even if it means subsidizing it, demanding that a certain percentage of tonnage that trades U.S. ports is domestically built, or something. Figure it out. If we do fight a near-peer war or a peer war in the future, we are going to quickly find out that neglecting this area of our industry and not subsidizing it so that it can exist when compared to low-cost and low-regulation countries is going to be a very big national security problem. Okay, rant over. Anyway, USS Reuben James had positioned herself between the ammunition ship and a German Wolfpack and was hit by a torpedo from U-552. Which was intended for the ammunition ship, well, at least according to the German claim. The torpedo hit the forward magazine, blowing the bow off the ship and causing the Reuben James to sink within 5 minutes. As it sank, the depth charges on her deck started to explode, killing many of the sailors who had managed to get off the ship with pure percussive force through the water. This is the horror of war. Only 44 of the sailors and no officers survived, out of a crew of 136 enlisted and 7 officers. I always think it's interesting to look at what the front page of papers say when a major event takes place. It gives an instant snapshot of what people knew and what they thought, but also what else was going on in the world at that time. On November 1st, 1941, the day after the Reuben James was sunk, here a smattering of New York Times headlines. The big top one is, U.S. destroyer sunk, 44 of 120 crew rescued. President sees no change in foreign policy. Germans gain and drive southwest of Moscow. But then there's also a headline that says, Lehman charges mayor's insults prove him unfit. Attack on court unforgivable. Governor declares at climax of rally of the campaign. Moses takes up defense. LaGuardia answering crime challenge. Cites report that forced Brooklyn inquiry. And then British envoy in Ankara reports attempt on life. But then we have local news again. U.S. funds asked for city program, building commission, adopting budget, wants federal aid for six-year projects. We have some regular World War II news. Tula battle rages, fighting now in suburbs of city, 110 miles from capital, Soviets say. Nazis gain in Crimea. But Russian support, Rostov stuck. Berlin claims Kalinin. And we have another. Senate lines hold. Advocates of neutrality revision say sinking solidifies, quote, majority. Vote move halted. Exchange of forces behind propaganda here enlivens debate. Army Operating Air Associates, Air Corps, backed by 2,100 soldiers, resumes work at strike-bound factory. Victory by Lewis seen in Capitol. Majority in mediation board for union shop predicted. Davis represents deadline. So there's a lot of union strife going on at the time, right? Despite the fact that the U.S. was very quickly going into a war footing. President holds to fixed policies. He does not expect sinking of destroyer to mean formal break with Germany. And then on the far right side, we have a column on the Reuben James. Reuben James hit. First American warship lost in war torpedoed west of Iceland. Was with a convoy. Details of sinking and fate of rest of crew not yet known. And all this is just to say that other stuff is going on. It's not just the war. And the Reuben James, for all the tragedy it was, yes, the big headline, but it was also just one column. There was a lot else going on in the world, and there was labor strife, there was mobilization, there was a wider war going on. But by the time Pearl Harbor happened, a little more than a month later, on December 7th, 1941, U.S. political and military leadership viewed the Atlantic theater as paramount and shifted a lot of naval resources, including many of the newest ships and aircraft carriers, battleships, and a lot of long-range patrol aircraft to the Atlantic. This is one of the reasons that the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was so successful, because a lot of the resources that may have gone into detecting an impending Japanese attack were diverted to the Atlantic theater, and rightfully so. It was considered far more important that Britain could not fall, because if Britain fell, the national security of the United States would be compromised, and there was quite simply no way that the Japanese were a threat to the mainland, despite the post-Pearl Harbor hysteria. We absolutely needed to keep Britain supplied, no matter what, even if that meant throwing our best assets into the not-so-neutral neutrality patrols. In retrospect, it is blatantly obvious that the Nazis were the bad guys, and we were absolutely right to get involved. But at the time, the war was very politically divisive, and the president was definitely overstepping his constitutional authority, and most of the country was still very isolationist before December 7, 1941, when Pearl Harbor shocked us out of our stupor. We probably eventually would have gotten involved in World War II anyway, but Pearl Harbor caused that to happen a lot earlier than it would have otherwise. Had we not gotten involved until later, there's a very good chance that the Soviet Union would have fallen. We, meaning the United States and probably Britain, almost certainly would have still won against Nazi Germany, assuming that we had the political will to finish the war. But the war would have gone on for a lot longer, and I think that there's a decent chance it would have ended with atomic bombs on Berlin instead of unconditional surrender via taking Berlin, which of course leads to some very interesting historical what-ifs regarding the Cold War or lack thereof. Anyway, that's it for this mini-episode on the Neutrality Patrols. I hope that you enjoyed it. If so, leave me 5 stars on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening. Please subscribe and you'll get the next one in your sleep. And you can always email me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. I'm going to take us out with Woody Guthrie's Sinking of the Reuben James.
Have you heard of a ship called the Good Reuben James? Manned by hard-fighting men, both of honor and fame. She flew the stars and stripes of this land of the free. Tonight she's in her grave on the bottom of the sea. Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Reuben James. What was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Reuben James. Well, 100 men went down in that dark, watery grave. When that good ship went down, only 44 were saved. It was the last day of October, we saved the 44 from the cold ocean waters of that cold Iceland shore. Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James? What was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James? It was there in the dark of that uncertain night that we watched for the U-boats and waited for the fight. Then a whine and a rock and a great explosion roared, laid the Reuben James on that cold ocean floor. Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James? What was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James? Now tonight there are lights in our country so bright. In the farms and the cities they're telling of this fight. Now our mighty battleships will steam the bounding main and remember the name of that good Reuben James. Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James? What was their names? Tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Reuben James?